Welcome to another episode of Good Night Tanzania with myself, Osama. Good Night Tanzania is a podcast meant to help ordinary South African people understand a little better where they're from historically, so that we together can come to understand the present. On all social media platforms, I am Osama Simone, and the podcast is Good Night Tanzania. I hope you'll like, subscribe, and comment with your views so that I may know what you think, of course. Let's see what's on the menu today. Welcome to another episode of Good Night Tanzania, everyone. This is an interesting one as well, just like, you know, the previous ones have been interesting in their own ways. And it sort of continues where we left off previous week. But I just want to, you know, refresh the memories of people who have been listening from, you know, from that very first episode with the geologist who, you know, who spoke to us about the history of the world and, you know, those billions of years that the world has been around. Because obviously, as you know, Southern Africa, we also belong, you know, to, you know, the global landscape as well. And we have to locate ourselves within that history. And so he came and, you know, told us about the duration of, you know, that the world has been in existence for, and told us that, you know, that we are standing on a lot of time in relation to all that's come before us. And then we also had John who came to, you know, to talk about early human life in Southern Africa and also in the world, telling us that, you know, many people on the world over are sort of said to have, you know, evolved from people from Southern Africa, which was very interesting, obviously, in terms of locating the South African landscape in the context of world history. And the key thing, I suppose, that we have learned is that there's a whole world that has existed before us that has not been written down, that has, you know, the history of which then is still very unknowable to ourselves, as, you know, as people who are living today. But today, I just want us to, you know, to pick up from last week's episode where we were visited by someone who spoke about, you know, the establishment of the Cape Colony there and, you know, the transformations, I suppose, even as early as they may have been at the time, the transformations that took place around that place. And but we never really got a sense of what was happening throughout the landscape, because you remember that Alex also came and spoke to us about Blackburn and Moor Park and Moloko, all those, you know, archaeological sites that they've been, you know, working on in the interior now, for which there hasn't really been, you know, social evidence, like that is meaningful Or like that is more full in terms of like drawing a more clear social picture of what was happening at the time. And so I think, yeah, like today that's going to be our preoccupation. We're going to be talking about the interior and, you know, the eastern regions during the 1760s and 1830s. And I suppose we'll also find out why like we are able to do social history during this period in the interior and in the east. But to help us get through these questions, to unpack them, you know, we're joined by John Wright. John Wright is a professor of history and a research associate at the Archive and Public Culture Research Initiative at UCT. He obtained his PhD in history from the University of the Witwatersrand. And in 2016, he was awarded the degree of Doctor of Literature honoris causa at the University of Cape Town for his prolific work as a researcher in pre-colonial studies in South Africa. John has published very widely, and he has also taught for a very long time at the Universities of Natal in PMB, in Pietermaritzburg, in KZN, at Rhodes, in the Eastern Cape, at Wits, in Johannesburg, and Cape Town. So it is obviously it's an honor for us to be joined by such an accomplished scholar. And we are, yeah, so we're really, really honored. Welcome to Goodnight Designing, John, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks, Zamo, and thanks for your invitation to be on the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. We also really look forward to you know, to hear your offer, you know, for us. But before we jump into the, you know, the crux of the episode today, I'd really just like to, you know, keep the conversation light at first, and but also very informative, I guess, because I'm very interested in what inspired you to choose history as a potential research interest that you would stick to for the duration of your career, and what highlights have, you know, been, I don't know, like important for you during the course of your of that career.
Oh, okay. Let me go way back to the 1960s, which is a long, long time ago. And yeah, I must make clear that, you know, I retired as a professional historian 15 years ago. So I'm speaking from that kind of capacity. But to go back, what took me into history in the first place? I'm thinking of my honors year at University of Natal in Pietermaritzburg in 1964. Well, part of the course was that we had to do a long essay involving archival research, real archival research for the first time. We actually went to the what was then called the Natal Archives to look at old newspapers from the 19th century, from the colonial period. Not old newspapers because they're relatively easy for young students like we were to deal with, but nevertheless take us back as documents from 100 years before. And this was my first experience of archival research as distinct from the kind of reading of books that one had done for undergraduate essays. And I found I enjoyed it and was good at it. I was able to put a story together from various different source materials. And this was really the first time I'd had this kind of experience of telling an extended story from various different bits and pieces of archive. Mm-hmm. And then a few years later, in the late 60s, I went on to do a master's degree, part-time this was, also at UNP, University of Natal, Pietermaritzburg, as it was then. And the subject was on the raids made by so-called bushmen from the Kahlamba Mountains on the cattle of the settlers and African people in the colony of Natal in the mid-19th century. No historian had ever done research in this field before, although I was very pleased to find, because we got on well, that parallel with my research, a rock art specialist, Patricia Van Eckum from Underberg, was also working on the same subject. But no historian. I was the first historian, actually, to work on it, and she was a rock art specialist.
Uh-huh.
And again, I thoroughly enjoyed the research. Nobody had done this sort of work before. I was bringing bits and pieces together from all over the place in the Natal archives. And yeah, I got an MA thesis out of it. Eventually, it was published in 1971 by the University of Natal Press as the book called Bushman Raiders of the Drakensberg, 1840 to 1870. So those are two experiences that, you know, from my student days that I can, you know, put in front of you that I can kick off with. It really captured my imagination as a researcher.
And as you've been working as a researcher, obviously, I understand you're saying that you were doing your honors in 1964, and then I'm assuming your master's also came within, you know, that decade. And what have been, you know, the highlights of your career? Obviously, as you've been in the discipline, and, you know, people have come and gone, I suppose, and, you know, those interesting, you know, in like relationships with other researchers as well, perhaps. Any highlights from there?
Certainly what has shaped my career for, heavens, would you believe it, 50 years almost, has been my involvement in the James Stewart Project, which I'm sure will come up for discussion, you know, later on in this.
Yeah, I've come across the volumes quite significantly as well in my research. Yes, we will talk about it.
Yeah. Because I was drawn into that by Colin Webb. He was a senior lecturer at UNP in 1971. And he wanted a research assistant for a project to publish the James Stewart papers. And I was appointed in 1971. And that was the beginning of a career which continues right up to the present. The six volumes have been put out, the last one in 2014, 6 years ago. But I'm currently working on and off on volume 7 with Mogisande Buthelezi. I don't know if you know him.
I'm aware of his work.
Well, he's executive director of the Public Affairs Research Institute in Joburg at the moment. Unfortunately for me, because it means most of his time is spent on that sort of administrative work where I wanted him to be involved as an academic. We're working on the Izibongo that James Stewart recorded in translating and editing these. So one day we'll have volume 7 out of the Izibongo, but you know, the project continues. But on top of that, more recently, and this has been very important for me, since my retirement in 2005, I taught briefly, as you mentioned, as a part-time teacher at Rhodes and at Wits. And then in 2010, I became involved in the work of the Archive and Public Culture Research Initiative, you know, with Carolyn Hamilton. Now, Carolyn is one of the leading figures in rethinking research and writing into the history of Southern Africa before colonial times. And she's one of the leading figures in Southern Africa into archival theory, theorizing what the archive is. And it's been extraordinarily rewarding for me to be able to work with her and also with her students. She's got a lively group of students around her. At any one time in the workshops that we have, there are between 20 and 30 people attending. And it's really probably the liveliest intellectual forum that I've ever participated in. And for this to happen to a historian in his retirement, you know, has really been a great privilege. And at a time of one's life when one is sort of winding down normally, but I've been involved directly in being able to think much further about the past before colonial times because of this involvement. And that continues in the present.
That sounds interesting. And I can imagine, you know, that not a lot of people get the option of extending their contribution to, you know, their profession, even way beyond, you know, the moment when they've left it, you know, like on that official basis. And just to, you know, move the discussion along, I just want to, you know, to sort of tentatively, you know, review history here, because many of the people listening to the podcast will have perhaps, you know, if they're not digital natives, you know, or so-called digital natives, they will be embedded in that culture of, you know, social media. And, you know, that and the smallness of, you know, like the globe now that, you know, given, you know, that access, you know, to information. And so a lot of people, you know, are overburdened with that stuff. You know, you have the internet to look up almost anything that you want to look up that has been researched. Of course, you know, the internet is problematic in its own way, like in that, you know, there are racist algorithms there, but like it's certainly become a vortex that hasn't, you know, been around before. And a lot of people sort of still struggle with digesting, you know, information in a way that is going to slowly but surely lead to higher levels of knowledge. And so I just wonder how you would say, you know, that the work that you professional historians do can, like, in this space, because in previous episodes we've had archaeologists who have a very distinct sort of method. They use, you know, they look into into material remains, and they, you know, they use specific dating methods which they can account for in a specific, you know, very within the discipline of science, obviously, with chemistry and things like that. But with social history, how would you say it relates to the scientific method in a sense? And because people, when, you know, take, for example, this idea of gravity for granted, you know, they know it's been proven for them, and there's no reason why they should be researching it every time they have to deal with it. But with history, people still, you know, carry around a lot of sort of misconceptions that aren't reflected in, you know, the works of professional historians. And so could you please just give us your take on history as a science?
Oh, okay. I'm looking at this very useful paragraph that you wrote here in the document that you sent me. The one beginning, the study of social history is something that a lot of our listeners would not be familiar with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
A major disadvantage with living in an information age is that one never really knows where to start pursuit of a life of knowledge and discovery. And I must say, I hadn't heard that phrase, digital natives, before. That's something new to me. Yeah, I take it. But then you continue, a history that in the public imagination remains contested and is laden with notions of race and supposed difference. And I think that's really, that should be our starting point, because many historians have moved beyond the notion of history as scientific inquiry. That's an old-fashioned positivist notion in many ways, which comes out of the Western Enlightenment and which was dominant in the development of history as a discipline in the West in the 19th century, and remained dominant in the history that was imported into the colonies, including South Africa, in the period of colonialism, when our universities were established in the early 20th century. So we landed up with a very positivist view of history. That is the notion that history is a scientific search for factual truth. Now, older and more conservative historians still hold on to something of this sort of approach to history. But many, I think probably most younger historians, and even this old historian, you know, has moved on from that sort of notion. It began to be seriously challenged in the West after the Second World War, after the absolute horrors of the Second World War in the cradle of supposed world civilization. Now, many intellectuals in the West started queering the whole notion of the Enlightenment, you know, very seriously, and moving beyond the notion that history was about truth and fact, and more towards the notion of history as, in the end, something to do with politics.
Mm-hmm.
The notion that history is not about the past, quote unquote. It's about what people say about the past, whether they're saying it in writing, whether they're saying it in the form of grandfather telling a family history, whatever. What they are saying is a form of knowledge making. And historians over the last 50, 60, 70 years have focused much more on questions of the nature of knowledge making in history and the nature of the source material, the archive, in other words, rather than just taking it for granted. As I say, that began in the West, but then since the 1960s, in the era of decolonization, intellectuals from the former colonial world joined in with a vengeance, starting very largely with India, you know, the first big colony to be decolonized. And intellectuals there challenging the notion that Western ideas could be taken as the norm. And so you have the development of what was called subaltern studies, the development of notions of decentering the West, the development of the ideas of putting Occidentalism up front for examination. Then more recently, what has been called theory from the South, which is where we find ourselves today. And then in Africa, particularly from the 1960s onwards, the era of decolonization, in universities north of South Africa to begin with, but then a little bit later here as well, and universities in Western Europe and North America, we got the development of what we can call post-colonial history, which moved on from the idea that history in the colonies was about white settlers, and white missionaries and officials, to the notion of putting the history of African societies up front. And from the 1970s onwards, there was a strong development on these lines in South Africa, in the white universities. White universities as they were in those days, because black intellectuals were hardly allowed to participate in them. And most black intellectuals, most black historians, in fact, were in exile and writing rather about struggle history. And that was their particular take on the post-colonial, and still is in some ways today. But then more recently, post-colonial history has given way to what's been called decolonial thinking, which, and here I'm quoting Lenhard Praig, who's professor of philosophy at the University of Pretoria. The decolonial has to do with challenging the particular grid of intelligibility imposed by Western colonialism on the world. I very much like that notion of the grid of intelligibility, the grid of knowledge. In other words, how people think. And that's a very powerful notion of this was imposed by colonialism. Now, more recently, a challenge to this whole way of thinking that goes beyond simple post-colonial thinking into decolonial thinking has been brought up by the Fallist movement since 2015. We know it fragmented quite quickly into numbers of different bits and pieces, and parts of it we know were hijacked by political opportunists. And it fell apart in many ways. But it has been described, the Fallist movement and its intellectual input, as the most important intellectual movement in South Africa since 1994 and the fall of apartheid and the establishment of constitutional democracy. So that's where we are at the moment, I think, right up front. We're concerned very much with the politics of making knowledge, I think, in progressive history, rather than history as some disinterested scientific inquiry.
Okay, and that's certainly a relief in that sense, because my next question, I suppose, as it seeks to zoom into the period that of interest today, in this episode, sort of stems from that political domain. Like I have visiting a friend in Soweto, I happened to be part of a within earshot of a conversation where people were talking about the Difakane or the Mfecane period, and that's not something that I used to grow up hearing about in my home, and so this was certainly very interesting to me. Well, interesting because I had read about it, but I had never really heard about it in my own, private life. And these people, sort of were linking it very directly to, this idea of Zulu-ness, in South Africa after apartheid, people, sort of have a very discrete way of understanding language groups and what those language groups sort of mean for how people see themselves. And this concept was very much linked to this idea of Zulu-ness. And so this was happening in Soweto, obviously. And it was confusing to me because this was not necessarily reflected in what I had read. And I had just read your paper in the Cambridge History of South Africa. I hadn't read anything else, like sort of continuing to the present from that time. And so could you please just, sort of open up with, what the concept means in the context of professional history and that research, that you guys, have undertaken on it as a concept and how it's come about and whether it had in its origins, it had anything to do with Zulu-ness.
Let me pick up with, again, this very interesting paragraph in the document that you sent me, that you've just talked about, in fact, this visit that you made to the friend in Soweto and overhearing this conversation, because I find that extraordinarily interesting. It's something I don't know much about and would very much like to find out more about, perhaps in the course of this discussion. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a very good starting point for this sort of discussion, starting in the present with what people are saying now, rather than with what some dry old academic is droning on about in the past. But I'll certainly come to that. But yeah, no, that notion of Zuluness in the present, I think extremely important to discuss. But okay, I'm kicking off with the notion of Fetane Difakane from a professional historian's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
The first point is that it's something that came into being or came into usage only relatively recently, that is in the 1960s, with the beginnings of an interest in the history of African societies among professional historians, as I mentioned a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, there'd been a lot of discussion in history written by white historians about the wars of Shaka, so-called. But that didn't take history of the KwaZulu-Natal region back before about 1815 or so, you know, more or less when Shaka comes to power. And the period before that was hardly discussed except as a prelude to the wars of Shaka. The rise of Dingiswayo was discussed. That had been discussed for a long time in the colonial literature. So that came in, but there was very little else. And it wasn't until the 1960s that historians started pushing back a bit further before the reign of Shaka. And at the same time, they rechristened the wars of Shaka, the Mfetlani. Now, exactly how and why this happened, I'm not sure. The first person to do this was John Omer Cooper, in what became a very famous and well-used book, The Zulu Aftermath, a revolution in Bantu Africa. And that notion of the Zulu aftermath gives you the key, because he gave it a new name, the Mfetlani, but still stuck with the notion that it had to do with Shaka and the wars of Shaka.
Mm-hmm.
And to go back a bit, where did this word come from? Well, the first inklings that we have of it are in the 1820s, in documents written by missionaries and officials about what Xhosa people were saying. And they were talking of Mfetlani or Mfetlani. But the hugely important point to make here is that it did not refer to a time of troubles and upheavals. It did not refer to a period of history. It referred to particular groupings that were seen as causing trouble in the Eastern Cape. Groupings of marauders who were moving in from further north, and particularly the Amangwane under the chief Matiwane Gamasomba. They were referred to as the Mfetlani. They were the original Mfetlani, if you like. The reference was to that group. And that kind of usage continued for a long time through the 19th century. And it wasn't until the late 19th century that a few historians started using the word Mfetlani to refer to a time, a period. And that's the meaning that got picked up by Omer Cooper in the 1960s. But where exactly he got it from, you know, I'm not sure. He died a few years ago, unfortunately, otherwise I could ask him. You know, I knew him slightly, but I wish I'd asked him more exactly where he got the word from. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that is the origins of the word itself.
Okay,
I was going to say that continued to be used through the 1960s and 1970s in that first generation of African academic historians until Julian Cobbing's critique in 1988, but that's another story which we'll come to.
Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Okay, I was going to say that's the, in brief, a sort of potted history of the notion.
Okay. Well, that certainly is a very interesting, you know, development of the idea. Something that I personally have never really heard, you know, being spoken of before. But just to tie, you know, this work with, you know, the work of a different historian who's been on this podcast as well. Alex Schumann spoke about changes from Blackburn, Moor Park and Moloko, which are these archaeological sites that they've been working on as archaeologists to sort of look into the second millennium farming communities and their rough sort of progression over time, I suppose, from the point of view certainly of archaeological remains and the things that they've you know, archaeologists have found in their sites as they've been doing their work and sort of curating it, obviously in a manner that makes sense within, you know, the frameworks that they use, you know, to, you know, to create a story, even though like obviously it's devoid of human voices and all those things. But she spoke about settlement patterns that were observed to sort of change over time, in that they started out looking more diffuse in how people sort of had like settled themselves or distributed themselves across the landscape, and a sense of centralization as we move across the centuries, and I wonder how within the context of social history and what people have been saying, you know, in the records, and because obviously that informs what people say today, what you found, if you find that that's necessarily the case in social history, if people talk about things like that, and what they say are the reasons for that.
Yeah, that's quite a complex question to try and answer. In the first place, you're asking about how do historical paradigms link in with archaeological paradigms?
Mm.
That's, you know, a very important question, because for the historian, the findings of archaeologists are extremely important in pushing back our knowledge of the past before about 1750.
Mm-hmm.
Look, let me make the point here. My main focus in my own research has been on the history of the KwaZulu-Natal region.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the dates that I mentioned will tend to be about that region. But broadly speaking, the oral histories that we use, and we'll come onto that later on, push back to about 1750 at the earliest in any kind of detail. Before that, we rely very heavily on what the archaeologists tell us.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we keep a very close eye on what they're telling us, and we, you know, those of us like Carolyn Hamilton and myself working in KwaZulu-Natal before the Shaka period, you know, we work closely with archaeologists like, say, Gavin Whitelaw at the KwaZulu-Natal Museum in Maritzburg, and keep an eye on what archaeologists like Alex Scorn are doing in other parts of the country. But I think a second point I need to make right now, because it's going to change the nature of the discussion we have, I think, is that, okay, you have put in front of me the chapter that I wrote for the Cambridge History of South Africa, published in 2010. Okay, that's only 10 years ago, and I would have written it in the previous 5 years or so. So, yeah, it reflects my opinions as they were 2005, 2008. I think 2008 I handed the chapter in.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, a lot of rethinking has been done about the period.
Okay.
Not to say that what I've written in the Cambridge history is wrong, not at all, but some of it is outdated. And I would use a rather different paradigm now from what appears in the Cambridge history. And I think perhaps, yeah, several things to talk about here, but let me start with this, that in the Cambridge history, we were still thinking very much in terms of states, a movement of small groups becoming bigger groups. Small groups before, say, the Ndwandwe and the Mthethwa chiefdoms, and then those chiefdoms giving way to the big Zulu kingdom. So growth from small to big, with the state as the kind of political formation that we end up with. Now, of course, we do end up with the Zulu state in the late 1810s and 1820s. But the point I want to make is that we cannot see a simple evolution from the period that the archaeologists talk about, before 1750, through the late 1700s into the early 1800s, of small getting bigger, of less complex becoming more complex. That's an older kind of idea.
Mm-hmm.
We're shaking up the whole notion of the state. Look, the state and words like chiefdom and tribe as well, for that matter, again, that's a word we can critique.
Yeah.
All these, in some way or another, put the emphasis on bounded polities.
Okay.
So polities in particular territories, with a particular chief or king and a particular set of subjects, if you like, who kwanza to their chief or king and speak a particular language and have a particular culture. That's very much the old tribal notion which developed under colonialism and, in fact, still is very, very strongly represented in notions of like chiefdom and kingdom. And even though we tried to use the isiZulu word isizwe,
mm-hmm.
which is a better word in some ways because it's more fluid and more open.
Yeah.
In English, we're moving now to the sort of the looser, broader notion of political formation.
Okay.
Because it allows us more scope. And we're thinking here not of bounded groups, but of groups, and this comes up very clearly in the evidence. If you start looking at the evidence in a different way, we put the emphasis on the mobility of people. People were moving all the time. It's quite clear from the evidence that such as it is. From one chief to another, they're going to Kwanzaa from one chief to another. Families were moving, individuals were moving, whole sections were moving.
Mm-hmm.
People were moving across the landscape to go and get married. The women moving all the time to go and get married in another group. And then there were traders. There were Izinyanga of all sorts moving across the landscape. So we're thinking in terms of much more fluid societies, where politics was fluid, where culture was fluid, and where in any one political formation, there might be several different cultural practices operating. Some of James Stewart's informants, in fact, his interlocutors that we can talk about later, make this point quite specifically, that any one chief had under him people who might speak several different, people who spoke several different languages. So instead of homogeneous, bounded, tribal-looking groups, we're talking of loose, fluid political formations. And we're only at the beginnings of thinking what the implications would have been for the nature of politics in societies of that kind. So what I'm saying is that now in 2020, I'll give a rather different take on the societies of the KwaZulu-Natal region in the late 18th century, early 19th century, from the take that I gave in the Cambridge history.
And so I suppose the point in this discussion, or in this question, is also to try to piece together a possible sort of version of like social relations or intergroup social relations, I suppose, and that competition for resources, because I understand even today, you know, people compete for resources, you know, all over the world. Obviously, you know, the images, you know, like that we see today might slightly differ to how people used to compete, you know, for resources at a different time. But I'm just trying to dress up, you know, that picture that comes from, you know, from you know the material remains in a society, because if, you know, said specific patterns can be said to come up in that sense, there must be some form of, you know, of explanations for those shifts necessarily, and also to, because we have such a very clear picture of what was happening at the Cape at the around the time, but there seems to be a social history that explains that part of the world, and is very clear about, you know, the activities, you know, the spread of the burghers, you know, in the southwestern region, and all those things. And I suppose it becomes attractive then when people can do things like that and can see, you know, human faces that they can recognize and sort of, you know, and sort of think about their characters, you know, more explicitly. It becomes tempting to try to do that for other regions and to dislocate the narrative, the conversation from just like physical remains, but like move to a more concrete understanding of the social realities of people. And so from the revised sort of framework, do people sort of try to approximate the social scene in the same way as perhaps, as you've suggested, that it was used to be done in the past?
Okay, that's a very good question, because it turns me back to what people expect from history. They want a story, understandably, and yeah, historians will give them a story. Let me answer that in two parts. What came out of the debates about the Mfetane, for me anyway, the most important thing was to locate the disturbances and upheavals of the time, and there's no doubt that they were, you know, all over the place, to locate them in a broader history of Southern Africa. This is really what comes out of the discussion that Cobbing got going. I don't think we have to talk about Cobbing much now, because his ideas are, you know, rather out of date.
Okay.
But what he did do was put up front the notion of the developments in African societies as somehow or other being tied in with the broader colonial and capitalist theme in Southern Africa. Before that, it's hard to think back to those times now, but before Cobbing's intervention, what was going on in KwaZulu-Natal in the so-called Wars of Shaka and the so-called Mfetlane that Omar Cooper put in front of us was the notion that these developments were all taking place quite separately from what was going on in the Cape. You had the Cape history going on by itself, down south, and then up in the north and the northeast, you had this set of upheavals, supposedly caused by Shaka and the Zulus. Now, what Cobbing did was bring these two things together.
Mm-hmm.
Made the point that we have to see developments in the northeast from the late 18th century onwards, as in some way or other tied in with the expansion of the Cape frontier.
Okay.
This was a new point at that stage, but it makes great sense and still does. Cape frontier expanding, and in advance of that Cape frontier were whole groups of poor frontiersmen, Korana people, Griquas, Bachanas, and others, with guns and horses, raiding quite a long way across the interior and causing destabilization. Traders were also coming in and trading for ivory in return for cattle and trading down south to the Cape. And then to jump across to the other side of Southern Africa, there was, from about the 1770s onwards, a growing trade in ivory at Delagoa Bay, with the Portuguese, English, French, and others involved there and wanting ivory from the interior and being prepared to pay in terms of cloth and exotic ceramics, beads, brass, and so on. And new political waves tying in with all this, raiding from the Cape frontier, trading from the Cape frontier, trading from the Delagoa Bay region. Trade itself, long-distance trade, this is well recognized in African history, was very much a source of political change, political conflict, because trade always brought new forms of wealth. And this caused the chiefs, the kings, to start trying to monopolize those sources of wealth for themselves. They hadn't been there before, those sources of wealth. Now, new sources of wealth, what do you do as a king or chief? You try and take control of it for yourself. And this caused all sorts of political tensions inside their own societies. And it's, in a sense, this sort of mixture that we're talking about nowadays when we talk about the Mfetlane or Difakane. It had its origins, these upheavals across the Northeast had their origins long before Shaka was born, long before the Zulu state was ever heard of. In these patterns, these movements that were rooted in a wider world history, a history that brought colonialism to the Cape and that brought capitalist kind of commerce to Delagoa Bay. And that's very different from just seeing the Mfetlane as something that was caused by one man, Shaka, and his armies. The Zulu were certainly important in the upheavals from the 1810s, 1820s onwards. And these upheavals had started long before that, in fact. The Zulu were one factor, yes, a very important factor, but by no means the only one.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really one of the main points coming out of the Mfetlane debate, as far as I'm concerned. And then you had a second question. Yeah, I was focusing the history more on goings on the ground. You know, what were people doing? Now, to answer that question, I have to say I can't answer it at the moment because I'm moving on from the ideas I put forward in the Cambridge history. And I point here to work that Carolyn and Hamilton and I are currently doing together. We're working on a book called, we haven't got a title yet, but the subject is politics and the making of identities in the KwaZulu-Natal region from the mid-18th century to about 1830, mid-18th century, when the evidence begins, as I said earlier, of oral histories, to about 1830, the end of Shaka's reign, his assassination, and the beginning of Dingaan's reign, politics and the making of identities. And we are looking in great detail at the records to be found in the James Stewart archive as source material. And this enables us, I suppose we're about halfway through the book at the moment, but what I can say is that we are putting a great deal of emphasis on the pre-Shakan period. The history doesn't just begin with Shaka or with Dingus Royal. It goes back before that. We've got enough now to have quite a lot on the Ndwandwe political formation and on the Tetwa.
From the volume itself.
Yeah, from the James Stewart archive. Yeah, and also in the case of Rwanda, from the Swaziland Oral History Project, where Phil Bonner and Carolyn Hamilton in the 1970s and 1980s did a lot of work in Swaziland among the rather different groups of Ndwandwe people who live up there and who still have, in many ways, a much more detailed memory of the remote, the deep past than do Ndwandwe people living in KwaZulu-Natal, who were subjected, first of all, to colonial domination and then to Zulu domination. And I'm talking of the present-day Zulu kingdom. And a lot of their history has been submerged, not entirely, but you know, it's very different from the history in Swaziland. And just as an aside, in fact, a colleague, Dr. Mongisene Telezi, whom I mentioned earlier, did his PhD on the Ubumbano Lwamazwete.
Okay.
The movement, which, like other Ubumbanos which exist, is you know trying to revive something of the old Ndwandwe history. And finding it quite difficult because there's not much in KwaZulu-Natal of this history. But in Swaziland, there's quite a lot more. Eswatini, I suppose I should be saying, no? So using those source materials, we've got quite a lot of detail on Ndwandwe history in the late 18th century. And there's a lot on Mtetwa history. And now we're also finding, and these are the case studies that we're going to bring out in several chapters in this book. There's a lot to be said about the Kwabe political formation, the Hubi, the Amatuno, the Kize, the Ngobo, Tuli, and the Tlele. Look, it's a fairly arbitrary selection in some ways. You happen to know about those groups partly because they were important in the time, but also partly because by accident, James Stewart happened to record quite a lot of information from his informants on these particular groups. But what I'm saying here is that we have enough case studies in these groups to give us, you know, a reasonably clear picture of the kind of politics that was going on the ground. And I'm doing this for the first time. And this is not something that we were doing 10 or even 15 years ago when you're writing a Cambridge history. We didn't have that kind of approach. The knowledge was certainly there, it was in the James Stewart archive, but the concepts in our heads and new ideas about mobility and fluidity and so on, we didn't have at that stage. That is something new. So as well as talking about the source materials, we need to talk about new concepts as well and where they come from. But anyway, the point I'm making here is that work is being done on this period, active work, very exciting work from Carolyn and my perspective. Because it's coming up with all sorts of new ideas about politics in the late 18th century that take us a long way away from the politics of the tribe as a bonded unit, to a very different kind of politics.
And from these interlocutors of Stuart's, are you able to get a sense of perhaps the formations maybe of gender identity, for example, and the dynamics within the home as well, who is considered, you know, to be part of the core family and who's considered to form part of the peripheral sort of continuities of the domestic space as it is conceived in that context? Because I'm obviously imagining that all these are farming communities because it's the eastern sort of summer rainfall regions, and if they're not farmers, they're pastoralists in one way or another, or they're hunter gatherers in the east as opposed to being in the west. And are you able to locate those dynamics as well, like in the conversations and how people, you know, saw themselves and how they related with others and you know, that those exchanges as well, but at the personal level?
Those are lovely questions, Mzama. The answer in brief is there's not much on that recorded in these conversations. You know, we're talking of a period of a Stuart is working in period early 20th century, 100 and 150 years after the period that we're talking about. There is something, there's a little bit, and certainly as far as possible, we are going to put the focus on gender relations, which is not all that possible, but certainly they're up there. Marriage patterns become extremely important. And that's something that hasn't been looked at before. And that is something that there is a lot of evidence from, where the chiefs marry so-and-so, or so-and-so goes to marry a chief. And you can work out patterns from that. Politically, that's very important. But no, on the whole, it still tends to be the politics of the chief and his advisors and his opponents. And the opposition, the opponents, are very important. And that's something, again, that probably is going to be new to this kind of history. The internal conflicts that take place, because they tend to be written out of the official histories where the kings and the chiefs rule uncontested. And that we can certainly show was not the case. But history at the family level, no, I'm afraid that doesn't really emerge until much deeper in the colonial period, when there are deeper resources. We're still talking here about the politics of the Isizwe. And also, but again, paying attention to the differences between these groups. Why are we looking at all these different case studies? Is because they show different patterns of politics depending on historical circumstance. They're not just following a tribal pattern, doing things because the chief says so, or doing things because it's tribal custom. That's an old-fashioned way of looking at African history, which became very strongly established in the colonial period, when the colonizers didn't think that Africans had history. All they had was tribes and tribal customs. But now we've got a much more sophisticated, we hope, notion of, let me say, a greater variety, a more diverse notion of politics comes up. Politics is made by historians, by people, by actors, historical actors, like chiefs, like others, their opponents, but at least getting away from the tribal model.
Moving into the rising of the Zulu kingdom, I suppose, and I know Mazisi Kunene has this epic poem, where he, sort of fleshes out his, I suppose, from his research and from the oral history, from the oral records as well, the story of Shaka. And it's also, Zilikazi Khumalo also has this opera, I think, I'm not very familiar with music, but he composed something that was, came in the form of a CD where he talks of Shaka Kasenza Ngakhona. And so the rise of the Zulu kingdom, like as you've said, sort of displaced the histories of people who weren't necessarily considered to be royal in the way that people are considered royal. And so then their histories sort of became submerged. But I'm interested now in just looking at the record, and I suppose this could be, sort of differently documented, because there seems to be in the record, in the archives, there seems to be a focus on the elites necessarily, the people who are seen to be lording over other people necessarily, or lording over anonymous people, the people who aren't necessarily that well represented in the record. What dynamics do come up as sort of informing or aiding or contesting the rise of this kingdom, and not necessarily kingdom, but like a political unit that sort of, moves in unison to sort of further needs or like aims that are seen to be self-serving? And what is the landscape looking like at the time? And perhaps, who are the people who come up in the record as sort of being key players around this period?
No, another very good set of questions. Look, the last two chapters of Caroline's in my book are going to be focusing very much on these issues, on the Shakan period. Drawing on work that Caroline did in her master's thesis and her PhD, and drawing on work done by historians, previous work like David Hedges, who had a very good PhD on trade and politics in southern Mozambique and Zululand in 1978. So it's not as if we are the first people to do this. Is something to draw on. But we are going to be concerned with, as far as possible, a very tight periodization of the rise of Shaka. And this is not something that has been done before, and it's something that's absolutely necessary from a historian's perspective. Looking virtually on a month-by-month, year-by-year basis, especially very early on in his reign, how does this guy actually come to power? He's an upstart. He's a jumped-up nobody. How does he end up as king of a very large region? And the answer is, okay, he's not only a first-class soldier, we know that because that's what the sort of legends tell us. He's a first-class politician, first-class diplomat, And what we're looking at, and we don't know the answers as yet, because that's still to come in our research, but a very close look at the making of alliances, as well as overcoming people by conflict. You know, the stereotyped history of the Zulu kingdom tends to be one of Shaka beating everybody up by conquest and dominating them through violence. Now, certainly there's a lot of that. But earlier on in his reign, like every other African chief of the time, he was concerned to set up alliances with others in all sorts of ways. And a lot of the early years of his reign are about doing exactly that, with groups like the Kwabe in particular. The Kwabe become extremely important, but also groups like some of the Amangogo groups, the Mkize. The Mkize are very important, Tsele as well. And their history emerges in a way that hasn't emerged before as a result of this. What do their leaders see in resisting Shaka or in making alliances with Shaka? Or in Kwanzaing him and, you know, giving their allegiance peacefully without fighting. And there's a lot of that as well. Leaders seeing that there's no way of opposing this guy, let's make an alliance with him. And a lot of that history is to be found in the Stuart archives. So, you know, it makes for a much more historical picture, if you like, historicized. It's not just great man history, Shaka leading his impis to conquest. It's the efforts, the actions of political agents, Shaka, his advisors, his opponents inside the Zulu kingdom. All of these have got to be dealt with. How did he do this? And we're looking not simply at the politics of this, but also at the political discourses, the discussions, the way in which these issues were negotiated. So politics wasn't just about force and violence. It was about negotiation. And this comes up very much as well in the kind of work that we're doing. There's enough little shreds of evidence to enable us to follow this. So we hope it's a more sophisticated picture of African politics. It takes us far away from, you know, just the tribal notion of tribes banging away at each other. Here we have political actors playing in a political context. What exactly is it that makes them act as they do? And then how, importantly, how do they portray this historically? How does this go down in history? And how does this get picked up by James Stewart's interlocutors 100 years later? You know, we've got to unpack their sayings, the stories they told him from their own perspectives in order to get at what was going on 100 and 150 years before. And that is the big methodological challenge that faces Carolyn and me. In fact, how to read these sources. And again, I'll just say something briefly on this and then keep quiet. A lot of people tend to open the volumes of James Stewart, or like they do Bryant, olden times, you know, Zululand and Natal, that much older work, and other works like Make Mafuze, Abantu Abamnyama.
Yeah.
They open these books, find a particular fact on the page, what they see as a fact, and just incorporate it into a story without asking where it comes from or what it means. And you just can't do that with this sort of stuff. You've got to ask, where does the archive come from? And so we spend a lot of time talking about that in the early chapters of the book, the making of the archive, the making of historical knowledge. It's not just there to be read off the page. We have to think about where it comes from and how it came to be on the page in the first place. Mm-hmm. So the notion of archive is fundamentally important to kind of as a basis for the interpretation that we're making. Talking so far mainly about the James Stewart archive,
mm-hmm.
that's very important in its own right, but it's been relatively easy for us to deal with the James Stewart archive because a lot of it is in English. There's some in isiZulu, you know, which I have helped you translate into English, so this James Stewart volumes are in English. But like Brian's saying, earlier source, it's largely in English. But now, in the last 10 years or so, and this is another major step since we wrote the Cambridge history, we've been delving more and more into what Professor Begezizwe Peterson and others have called the Black Archive, the writings of Black intellectuals since the second half of the 19th century. And becoming aware, we white historians, becoming aware of the extent to which these issues were discussed and debated in isiZulu by Black intellectuals from the late 19th century onwards. Amakolwa, the sort of people that Tonipa Mokwena has written about, the contemporaries of Make Mafuze, others.
Uh-huh.
But writing, first of all, in newspapers like Inkanyiso, Ipepa Lohlanga, the 1880s, 1890s, and then Ilanga Lasenatale, which is well known today, founded by John Dube in 1903. Now, they're not just newspapers in the sense newspapers are today, largely reporting current affairs. The organizers and writers of these newspapers saw them very much also as forums for debate. And so their columns are full of discussions of public affairs and of the past. This is an important point I want to make. So they're major sources of historical information. We're only just beginning to tap into those. And yeah, please tell your listeners, if there's anybody out there wanting to do a PhD in KwaZulu-Natal history, the pages of Inkanyeso and Ipepelohlanga and Ilanga in the late 19th century, early 20th century are full of stuff that can be researched. So yeah, that's just a bit of advertising.
Yeah, very well received.
And also, just I'll finish off on this. There are also the history books and the novels and the plays and the semi-fictional biographies that started to be written in isiZulu in this early 20th century period, and that contain not necessarily truthful information, but takes, concepts, perspectives on the African past that you won't get in the colonial records. And there's Makhe Mofuzes, Abantu Abamnyama itself, which is the first book in Zulu. But then there's Petrus Lamula, Nozulu Gamalandela, in 1924. John Dube's novel, Insila Gashaga, in 1930. The fact that it's a novel doesn't mean that it's not historical at the same time. And we historians need to unpack Dube's writing of it. Where did he get his ideas from? What concepts was he using? Does this help us understand the sources that take us back 100 years before that? And of course, there's Rolf Zomo, who wrote Nomadanga Gandengezi in 1934. And then there's historical, semi-historical, semi-fictional works, Utdinga in 1936, Ushaga 1937, and Benedict Vilagazi, Utdingiswayo Ga Jobe, 1939. Another novel that again needs to be unpacked for its historical perspectives.
Are these all novels by Dlomo? Sorry.
No, they don't call themselves novels. He tells you that he's writing a story about Dingaan and a story about Shaka, but he puts words into their mouths, you know, which they probably didn't speak. So he's fictionalizing them. But nevertheless, the way that he does that could be very important for the historian.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's all part of the Black Archive, which we are just starting to rediscover. And of course, you know, isiZulu speakers have been able to deal with this, you know, for 100 years or more. But most white historians, you know, can't read African languages. Unfortunately, I mean, we grew up speaking a bit of isiZulu, so I've been able to work in the language. And Carolyn has taught herself to read isiZulu as well, extraordinarily. But this is something that historians simply have to take seriously. And the newspapers as well, particularly, full of material. So yeah, a lot of work out there still to be done on the source material.
When we sort of spread ourselves out, and I know obviously your key area of focus is that area bounded by the upper portion of the escarpment in the Indian Ocean. Just to get a sense now of a broader image before we move towards the picture that was there before the Great Trek now from, you know, the Cape, given those dynamics that were happening there, you know, the breaking away of the Boers and moving towards an area where they could operate in a manner that was unencumbered by this, you know, this British, you know, quote unquote liberalism. But what images that are sort of necessarily contemporaneous with the times of Abo Shaka, Abo Ndwandwe? I don't know if Ndwandwe and Zuida are the same, refers to the same concept, and all these other contemporaries around time. What images are you able to, if obviously you possess this knowledge, and given, you know, the revisions that you've made to the work that I had used as a basis for these questions, but I'm trying to get a sense of the interior and what those politics might have looked like between, you know, the Bafokeng, the Bahuruche, Bakatla, Bakwena, and so on and so forth.
Oh, yes. And the Eastern Cape as well.
And the Eastern Cape, yes, yes.
Yeah. Look, I mean, in brief, that is work that still has to be done in the sense that one has something of a knowledge of what's going on there from the colonial travelers who were writing in English, and same in the Eastern Cape. But it's a very partial and skewed set of images that comes out. And really, in the same way as images of Zulu history have to be rethought, you know, on the basis of information found in KwaZulu-Natal, so in the interior, you know, we need historians now who can read Setswana, who can work in Sesotho and take us through the missionary records, for instance, and the missionary newspapers that were coming out from the mid-19th century onwards. They were largely written by Black people, part of the Black archive again. And similarly in the Eastern Cape, where it starts probably before any other region, because the missionaries got there very early, and you get the emergence of a group of Amakorwa with writing and reading knowledge very early on. and Isixhosa language newspapers starting there very early. Fortunately, in the Eastern Cape, quite a lot of work has been done recently on the importance of pushing the Black archive back again to where it should be. Again, Black historians and intellectuals have been writing about this stuff for 100 years. You know, since the time of Mkai, Kobusano, others, writing in the late 19th century, early 20th century.
Diosopa.
Yeah. An enormous archive there that needs to be unpacked. And now historians, young historians of the Eastern Cape, are starting to do just this in a very exciting sort of way. It needs to keep tabs on them. They're, you know, one of the major centers now of rethinking the whole history of the Mfetane period, especially as it affected the Eastern Cape, is coming out, you know, from a new generation of historians.
Okay. I understand, obviously, like in the mid-1830s, there is that migration of the Boers, as I sort of alluded to earlier. And obviously, they also spread themselves, you know, so differently. And that is a conversation for another day, I suppose, with a different scholar. But what was the picture on the ground, I suppose? And is there an archive that comes from these individuals who are spreading themselves out there? And obviously, because obviously history is also very skewed by the political landscape, you know, under which it is produced. So we obviously are, I'm asking this question, you know, with and expecting to take it with a pinch of salt necessarily, because I don't expect for it to be, you know, the messiah of truth, you know, necessarily, but I'm just trying to get a sense of what versions were presented about, you know, that moment now of interaction between these people spreading themselves, you know, across the landscape, and the people that we have been discussing who had, you know, had been established there as second millennium farmers for like, you know, like centuries, I suppose.
Yeah, no, good question. Look, there is a Voortrekker Boer archive, because many of them, you know, had writing. Not all of them were literate, but many of them were. And there is a official archive, and also, you know, something of a missionary archive as well, particularly in the Transvaal, what used to be called the Transvaal. It dates back to the period of domination by the Boer states. And for anybody working in that area, you know, it's just an archive that has to be looked at, who wants to know about the history of African societies. Because read in a certain way, it's quite clear that something of the history of African societies does emerge. It's the same with Natal and the Eastern Cape. You know, you cannot ignore the colonial archive. You've just got to learn a very critical way of reading it. And of course, you've got to read all archives critically. But the point is, the material is there and it has to be researched. It needs to be researched. This is only just beginning again, because the Boer archive has tended to be used very much for the writing of Afrikaner nationalist history. But in between that, it's clear from the writings of some Afrikaner historians that there's quite enough to write about the history of various African groups as well. So again, there's more work to be done by people who are fluent in Setswana, Sesotho, Sepedi, and early and late Afrikaans. A lot of work to be done. Lots of languages needed in this country to be able to work in this period.
Mm.
Throw in French, German, Swedish, Norwegian, as well as English, you know, to be able to work in the mission archives.
Mm.
Yeah, they all carry something on African history.
And I know you've, you know, like as we've been going along, you've been sort of, you know, throwing, you know, into like the discussion, new work that is happening around this period and study that we've been looking at. But I'm wondering, like in the South Pinsberg, or that very northern region close to the Limpopo, I wonder what new work is coming out of professional historians and the ways that they are doing the work now, obviously, which I can imagine is much more vast compared to how history has been done in the past, certainly. But are there any new historiographies that are coming out from historians around that time, looking at that region and sort of integrating the activities happening around that time within the larger context of politics and reciprocity as we've been doing to this point?
You ask about the Serpensberg area. Look, I'm not sure about that, quite honestly. There's a great deal of archaeological work that's been done because Mapungubwe is slap bang in the middle of it. And an enormous amount of work has been done by archaeologists at Mapungubwe. But you're asking about historians in the 19th century. And so now, look, I'm not sure. I don't know enough about that area. Certainly further south in what is now Limpopo province, work has been done. Recent work has been done on the archive of the Berlin Mission, which was active there from the 1860s onwards, right into the 20th century. And there's a very rich archive in Berlin and other parts of in Pretoria as well, I believe, on various groups living in today in Limpopo. So again, work is starting to be done on that, on missionary records and on Boer official records as well, relating to the history of African societies. But again, it's an area I don't know all that much about. But
And how are we to look out for these books that you've mentioned? You've been dropping a lot of book titles that are upcoming, necessarily collaborations between yourself and Professor Hamilton at the APC, there in Cape Town, and there's other work that is coming out from in the interior and in the north as well. Like, are there perhaps publishers that you're expecting to be putting out your books in the near future? Because I know I subscribe to Vets University Press as pages on social media, and I see their outputs, and I'm able to keep up with those guys. But with other publishing houses, it's still a bit elusive for me. How do we get a grip on that information and how to track it?
Oh, as you've been doing, I think, keeping tabs on the publishing houses. Well, no, I mean, the best I can do is sort of send you references. Sounds like you've got most of them. But again, I cannot resist a bit more of self-advertising here. See, you've opened the way for it.
For sure.
Issues about the archive are being taken up in a book of essays aimed at students rather than at high academics, aimed at student level, which is edited by my colleague Cynthia Cross in Cape Town, Mogiseni Buthelezi, whom I mentioned earlier, Helen Ludlow, and myself. It's titled Ezakdala / Tsakhale, Exploring the Archive of Times Past. It's been submitted to Wits University Press, and Wits University Press are very interested. I just hope they publish it, and I hope they keep the title. I don't know, the title might change if they do publish it.
Okay.
But, it's a series of short essays written by some very senior historians for the most part. Black historians, white historians, on the nature of the archive available on the pre-colonial, I am using that word pre-colonial. The very first thing this book does is critique the notion of pre-colonial. And we use phrases like history before colonial times, because pre-colonial is a no-no. We can use it in shorthand, perhaps, but in a formal sense, no one's got to move beyond that notion, because it kind of implies pre-colonial, colonial, post-colonial, as if that's what history is all about.
Yeah.
The colonial right up in the middle. No, anyway, this book is exploring the archive of the past before colonial times, largely as it pertains to KwaZulu-Natal and the interior regions of, Gauteng, Lesotho a little bit, and Limpopo area. It doesn't deal with the Eastern Cape, and it doesn't deal with the Southwestern Cape, which we haven't spoken about, because the field is just too big. It's huge. So we focus very specifically on KwaZulu-Natal and sort of the Gauteng and the areas around it. And the academics that we invited to contribute to the book come mainly from Gauteng and KwaZulu-Natal, with some in Cape Town and a couple of overseas as well. But writing on archives, like we've got Hlonipho Mokoena writing on Abantu Abamnyama, she's got a chapter there. I've got a chapter on James Stewart, and also others writing on their own lives, how they became explorers of the archive. Like we have Professor Nihwati of Wits University
telling us.
Sikiba Kiba, how he became an academic. Prof. Sifiso Ndlovu from UNISA, telling us how he came to write a PhD on the image of King Dingaan. And Dr. Nduguyake Ndlovu in archaeology at the University of Pretoria, telling us how he became an archaeologist in spite of quite a lot of difficulty that he faced in becoming an archaeologist at Wits. And so on. We've got various others, 19 or 20 chapters all in all, writing about this archive and the exploration of the archive. But again, putting up front for our student readers the importance not of so much of what happened in the past, but the question of how do we know what happened in the past? What are the sources? Where do they come from? And emphasizing again, that's an absolutely central question for anybody working on the period before, you know, of history, before colonial times. So yeah, keep a lookout for that book as well, if when it comes out. Otherwise, mm-hmm. you know, the best I can do is simply, you know, send me emails asking and I can just send you titles and directions to look in.
All right. Well, I think it's safe to pause our conversation here and, you know, and sort of leave the baton, you know, to be taken on by, you know, the next scholar, whom I believe will be Robert Ross, if we're lucky enough. And yeah, thank you so much, John, for joining us. And, you know, your contribution has certainly been very insightful and also very important, because it's very easy for non-specialists, you know, like myself, to fall into the established traditions uncritically, I suppose, you know, overlooking the fact that, you know, knowledge is, you know, like every knowledge, you know, offer is always very provisional and subject, yeah. You know, to specific, you know, like, I don't know, to the context, you know, under which, you know, they occur or come up, and so on and so forth. So thank you so much for, you know, accepting our invitation.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. It's been a pleasure to speak to you. And thanks for the questions.
Well, that's it for today. Thank you for listening. I hope to catch up with you next week on another episode of Good Night, Azania. Good night, Azania.
Ujungane gandaba, ujungane wombelebele, ujunge manxulumene, usekwasa manxulumesibekelana. Ute kulabafazi bakwaNomkhali, bethe kula behle zemlovini, bethu shabusa kaye kubankosi, kanti kunyaka nezakunethe.
Indeed, I'm a great Moriarty,